Welcome to Fast Forward by Commotion, your regular glimpse into the future of urban mobility. As always, I'm your host, Greg Lindsay, Director of Strategy for Commotion. And returning this week, my usual co-host, VP of Media Marketing, Jonah Bliss. Welcome back, Jonah.
Hey, Greg. It's great to be here. Happy to have returned from Yosemite, where I survived a PG&E power cut. So glad to be back in civilization.
Never change, SoCal. Never change. Well, welcome back. If you're listening to this, it means, and you're listening to this at the moment this hits the interwebs, tomorrow is the U.S. Presidential elections. It's been a long 4 years, but it's finally, Jonah, it's finally Infrastructure Week. We're going to get something whether we like it or not here. But I would say, I mean, obviously, this is a moment that hundreds of millions of Americans have been waiting for. Obviously, in the midst of a pandemic, there's not a lot to be said. But I'm hopeful that, that whatever emerges from this, and polls would seem to indicate a Vice President Biden victory here, that, you know, that we'll perhaps see a Congress that will become unstuck. We'll see final stimulus. I'm mostly appalled that Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, after passing the confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett, sent home the Senate and without any passing any stimulus. The markets reacted accordingly. But perhaps we're going to finally see, and we're going to touch upon this in Commotion LA in a bit, the notion of how do we actually start reinvesting in America, and whatever happens in the next administration, we see the investments in electrified infrastructure and new forms of mobility that America so desperately needs, perhaps unlocking the private sector or perhaps focusing on public funds. We'll see what our choices are. But I don't know, Jonah, I guess as a way of focusing this conversation for our mobility is, what do you think is the most pressing mobility-related item at the top of the American agenda? So, you know, if you came into office on January 21st, what would be the top of your to-do list?
I get to put on my presidential hat now. I think it's always going to be that huge question. Obviously, any sort of reinvestment is contingent upon securing the Senate. But B, we've sort of gotten two different stories from Joe Biden. He's both the train loving, just man on Amtrak from Delaware, but he's also the good old American muscle car. They don't make them like this anymore, kind of guy. So it'll be very curious to see, how much of any push towards, reinvestment, new infrastructure, et cetera, is geared towards either, EVs everywhere, building a charging network, subsidies for purchase, retooling plants versus actually spending some real money to reinvest in, Amtrak, public transit in cities, more sustainable shared modes of transportation. So, I'd prefer the latter, but this is America, so I wouldn't be shocked if it's more the former.
Yeah, I mean, this seems without a doubt that if there is a Biden administration, there'll be huge EV credits for all and much less clear exactly about what will be done for public transportation. I mean, obviously, the top of the agenda, you'd want to finally see that bailout for public transit. But I would at least hope, given perhaps the new report from Bloomberg New Energy Finance, that that the costs of wind and solar are about to drop below already invested natural gas. It's sad on some level. Yeah, it's incredible. And that's why it's really sad to see, all the presidential candidates kowtowing to fracking for reasons of swing state voters and the jobs it implies when the market's about to kneecap the entire fracking of natural gas sector simply due to efficiencies. So, I hope we'll see an electrification agenda for all and then more focus on, electrifying America's bus fleets, for example, and which comes in handy because I should note here, close to the top of the podcast, and I was almost remiss that our guest this week, in the second half of the pod, is Avinash Rugabur, who is the President and Chief Strategy Officer of Arrival, which is making an electric bus and is building micro factories, as they call them, in cities around the world to basically bring production closer. So, hopefully they would be part of this agenda here to see investment in new kinds of electrified mass transport. But boys can dream, I suppose, for the two of us. But moving on from the dreaminess and from months ahead on the other side of a presidential transaction, there's other agenda items on there. I don't think there's anything as momentous this year on the agenda as Measure M in Los Angeles 4 years ago, raising $100 billion plus over however many years for transit. But what else do we have? There's obviously candidates up in Miami that are being judged on this and elsewhere. Yeah. What's on your election day radar?
I mean, as always, there's local measures, there's candidates in different races that transit is very much a local story, especially nowadays, given that federal matching funds aren't what they used to be. So, you know, one race we're watching, given that we're kind of, you know, also invested in the Miami community, the county mayor is up for election. So the two main candidates are Esteban Bovo and Daniela Levine Cava. And our friends at the Miami Riders Alliance have scored both of them on their sort of public transit friendliness. And in good news for Magic City denizens, they both get passing grades. One of them might be a D, but that is technically, you know, a passing grade, as any Ivy League student will tell you. So I'm not going to say who gets the A, who gets the D, but check it out, Riders Alliance. And yeah, just encouraging to see, you know, no F scores here at the very least.
I would say, well, that is definitely encouraging, particularly, you know, in one of the less, yeah, when I think of Florida, I'm not thinking particularly of strong investments in public transport, but I'm glad to see the local candidates are doing that. Well, what else do we have in mind? I would say the coming back to the world of Tesla, I hate to do it, Jonah, but we must always talk about Tesla, always bring the content.
You know, it's funny. This is almost a week free of Tesla, but then the Twitterati drags us back in. So Consumer Reports just put out their annual review of various, you know, OEMs, ADAS, self-driving, whatever you want to call it, systems. And actually topping the rankings is the GM Cadillac Super Cruise. And part of what they like about it is that it's just like a little more maybe honest with the driver of you know, when it's going to work, when it's not going to work, what your responsibilities are, like, you know, keeping you on the road and not playing your Switch while you have the car drive. So it came in first. Tesla's Autopilot came in second overall. And then there's like a pretty steep decline in scores after that, with I think Mazda's iActive Sense coming in like a scarily low last place, which makes me terrified that anyone might have that running in their car. And this, you know, should be a cool story for GM and Cadillac. But then, of course, as soon as we tweeted it in a very innocuous, just like summary, the Tesla fans just started arguing with our the Commotion Twitter account that, you know, Consumer Reports is paid off by GM. So, Jesus, people.
Well, I'm too scared to look, but you got to think the obvious play there for the Tesla files is to basically say, well, that was Autopilot, and now we have full self-driving. So, you know, Consumer Reports is just behind the curve on this. So.
Exactly.
But it's really amazing how good of an ADAS system you can make if you just call it that and don't insist falsely and misleadingly that you are in fact selling a level 3 system, not a level 2. I would say when it comes to Twitter, I've enjoyed Alex Roy shouting himself hoarse out there, pointing out what in fact full self-driving actually is, and it ain't that. But, you know, again, he's paid off by Ford, I'm sure they would say, with his Argo affiliation. But what else do we have in the world of electric vehicles this week and autonomy? I believe there's some Fisker news we've got.
There's always some Fisker news. Hot off, you know, their SPAC and choosing their new headquarters with scary names. Henrik revealed the number of pre-orders they had as of the 26th of October at this point. 8,871, which I guess he found impressive. I don't know. I mean, given it seems like Tesla sells that many in a week, I'm not sure that's amazing, but you know, it's better than zero.
That's pretty good. It's pretty good. Well, speaking also of electric vehicles, what have we got? I would say we've discussed electricity at the beginning here. I mean, we're more likely to get, you know, credits for, you know, electric trucks for everyone before we get electric buses. Who is the newest entrant here? Who's bringing up the rear on this?
If you had a name like Mike Manley, what would you be selling? So that's the CEO of Fiat Chrysler, of course. And he just announced that the iconic Ram will be bringing a giant EV truck to the market soon. And yeah, in some ways, I mean, you know, these kind of work vehicles, they make sense for the EV form factor, right? You got all the space to stash the batteries. You might want that kind of high torque performance. But the problem is, of course, that most pickups aren't actually driven by people, you know, hauling loads to the construction site. They're just sitting in people's driveways and then waiting to run over your kids on the way to soccer practice.
a surprisingly controversial opinion on that last point there. But yeah, I know the fact that EVs are being used to basically increase the curb weight to the maximum the envelope allows is a bit of a distressing trend. But
how's your stop distance on that monster truck?
Yeah, exactly. But that's the way it's been headed there. But again, we'll see. I mean, that points to, as we've had some past guests on the podcast lately with Angie Schmidt, who's Right Away, of course, has been talking a lot about this. It'll be interesting about, again, changing the culture of mobility in the United States matters as much, if not more, as changing the economic incentives and the various policies there. So we'll see how it all pans out. But with that, Joe, I think unless we're out of news here, I think it's time to kick it over to Avinash, because yes, he is not selling an electric truck that is 12 feet tall. Then they're trying to reinvent the humble bus, which is something that I am all in favor of. And also, more to the point, creating electric vans, because that is a very hot B2B category. They've got investment partnerships with UPS, which is how they're getting their foot into the door into this market. So without further ado, let's kick it over to Avinash. Thanks for joining us, Avinash.
Thanks for having me, Greg. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you as well. So I guess it's a place to start. The recent announcement just the past few weeks of the South Carolina Microfactory, which is a particularly fun nomenclature for us because, we're known for not taking Tesla too seriously around here. So while everyone else is aspiring to build gigafactories, you're building microfactories. But I was curious if you could talk a bit about that. I mean, in addition to being, of course, an EV maker, and so many companies trying to, do electric and autonomous, you guys are trying to, of course, transform the manufacturing process as well. So, can you tell us a bit about what makes it a microfactory and how you intend to really sort of change traditional production techniques in addition to innovating on the product?
Right. So you're right. We are looking at this very holistically. So what we're really trying to achieve is making sure that electric vehicles are price competitive to fossil fueled ones. And to do that, actually Arrival's been around since 2015. We've got over 1,300 employees. And we've been heavily focused on looking at the problem as a whole. And when you look at one of the barriers to getting electric vehicles at the right price point, is this requirement to really get the economies of scale using traditional methods of producing hundreds and thousands plus of units. And looking at that, we're vertically integrated. So we're doing the software, we're doing the components, we're building these vehicles in a very different way. And we questioned, why does the production process have to be that way? And we looked at basically, how can we break that rule of economies of scale? And so we designed our vehicles around this idea of a local microfactory. And what's important about the microfactory, significantly lower capex. It is a much lower footprint. So you can convert existing warehouses to becoming production factories for our vehicles. And they're rapidly scalable. So you can put them anywhere and turn them within 6 months into an actual production facility. And so that was really important so that we could produce these best-in-class vehicles, make them competitively priced, but also bring them back to local environments. So as you mentioned, we announced a microfactory in South Carolina recently. It's one of many that you'll see us being announcing and going into different cities around the world with this microfactory.
I was going to say, what are the projected volumes to be compared to an Automotive Planet? How does it even matter? I mean, I guess you end up obviously with many more locations. How do the economics work out?
So if you think about what happens in a traditional plant, let's start with, just the footprint. So you're talking about millions of square foot. You've got a significant amount of capex. You've got a paint shop. You've got a body stamping plant. You've got general assembly. We've really simplified all of that. So for example, the composite materials that we've built means that you don't need a paint shop and you don't need a metal stamping plant. So you've already removed the capex around that and also the space requirement. And if you look at the way our products are designed, they're all designed to be built using this microfactory. So it's this vertical integration that I was mentioning earlier. It's all in a loop between design, engineering, and manufacturing through this microfactory. And so what that means is the whole unit economics, the whole dynamics of this approach changes. And so if you compare it to a traditional plant, we're able to be significant reduction in that capex. So if we wanted to produce the same amount of vehicles through microfactories, we'd be less than half the price of a typical factory in terms of CapEx. And then, you know, with the footprint that we've mentioned, it's you know, more than four times less footprint as well. So that's to produce equivalent volumes. But a microfactory enables you to also produce lower volumes profitably. And this is really important because it means that, let's say, the city of London versus the city of New York, we're able to create different mobility solutions and still produce them profitably. And that hasn't actually been able to happen in the industry because, you know, before you had to produce hundreds of thousands to get the profitability for this to make sense. And so we're able to have higher margin per vehicle, you know, lower CapEx, lower OpEx. And essentially, we see that this is the future of how production needs to happen.
Interesting. Related to that, I mean, I'm curious as to why you chose South Carolina. I mean, I can imagine, obviously, you know, the South has been a center of auto production for a while. And of course, states give out very generous packages too. But it's been interesting in light of the fact of, you know, efforts by the state of Michigan and others, for example, to reinvent themselves as, again, the future of mobility in America. Do you think, I mean, you know, does the sort of automotive clusters that have developed in the United States over decades still matter as much, even with the microfactory? And where else do you imagine? I mean, are you going to build one close to every major metropolitan center, or do you need to be nested still in those supplier networks the way traditional OEMs are?
That's a really good question. So I think the short answer is that we expect the microfactory to be placed anywhere there's local demand. And if you look at, you know, anywhere where there's, you know, a population over, you know, 500 to a million, you're able to place these microfactories and produce the necessary volume of vehicles. So a van microfactory, for example, produces 10,000 vehicles. A bus can produce 1,000 buses. So you're really able to, you know, South Carolina is one. Obviously, it's got the supply chain there already. And it's also close to, you know, a place like Charlotte, where there's a ton of new startup activity and engineering activity. And it's a good launching point for our U.S. expansion. But you can imagine the way we think about this is you would have microfactories essentially spread out all across the country and indeed the globe, that are all based near local areas of demand. And these things can be, you know, near to urban centers. It's literally you take a warehouse and you start filling it with all the necessary robotics. And, you know, in 6 months, you have a production facility. The supply chain is a really interesting point because the industry right now works by, you know, these large factories out in the middle of nowhere, and then you ship completed vehicles across the world, right? So the logistics costs and supply chain, the supply chain is all centralized, but the logistics cost is quite high, right? To ship full size vehicles. We take the inverse of that. You know, we ship the smaller parts to the micro factory where there's local supply chain. We use that local supply chain. We expect even for, you know, urban economic development, the local micro factories will attract a stronger supply chain network within that region. And then essentially, in terms of the vehicle is produced right where it's going to be used. So you're changing the dynamics of where you're spending on the supply chain versus the, you know, end delivery of that vehicle. And the analysis we've done, it's the right way to do it for the vehicles that we're building.
Interesting. Well, shifting from production to the product itself, I mean, my favorite thing about Arrival, obviously, is the fact that you guys chose a bus to start with. I mean, you know, and there have been, you know, some of the classic other big OEMs, Daimler and others, are developing, you know, electric autonomous buses. But yeah, seeing start with a true bus, not a microtransit vehicle, not the so-called bread box model, you know, right, of some of your competitors. But yeah, why did you choose to focus on a city bus first, effectively, and of course also a van variant too, and yeah, and why these two particular types, and how do you imagine, you know, evolving them, I should say?
I think we're looking at this as how do we redefine urban mobility? And urban mobility must and should always include public transportation. And public transportation is an area which has been, you know, critically underserved. And we believe that we need to find products that can enhance the public transportation network. And that's not just through, you know, creating a electric bus, but it's also by creating an elevated user experience. So this idea that, you know, again, we're going to be price competitive with diesel buses, and we've got, you know, obviously the total cost of ownership benefit. So it's the right thing to do, let's say from a commercial perspective, but we want the users to also, the passengers to really feel like, wow, I've got the latest technology. So it's not just a bus that's at the right price point, it's got the right experience. So you're getting the connectivity you need. You know, the way we've done the bus, you can configure the seating really rapidly, for example, in a COVID environment. All the vehicles are connected, so the fleet operator can better manage the bus fleet, and on and on and on. You know, contactless payments. It's really taking the best of technology and bringing it to an underserved market. And so we're really excited. Starting with the bus means that we can have, you know, positive social impact straight away. And if you look at, you know, urban, you look at cities, they're going to need to shift from diesel to electric, both because of the environment and also because, you know, people are demanding that, right? Society is changing and understanding how important sustainability is for all of our futures. And starting with a bus and then moving into a van, which is another high volume product, as we know that the growth of e-commerce and delivery, and again, with a COVID environment, that's going to only continue to grow. But those are two, again, another market that really has been underserved and hasn't really changed over the last few decades. And we think they need to go electric and they need to have the best experience.
Interesting. I mean, obviously, we talked about, you know, you're a UK company and we've talked about your US factory, but obviously you could serve global markets. And I'm curious, where do you think the biggest appetite is for your electric bus product? I mean, you know, Proterra and BYD and others in the States have been trying to break into public transportation. Obviously, procurement is a devilish process indeed. But I mean, obviously, China's, you know, made huge leaps and bounds with electrifying the bus fleets of Shenzhen and other cities there too. So I'm curious, you know, where do you think are the biggest potential markets and fastest movers when it comes to deploying your bus?
I think the barrier to the rapid electrification of any segment has been the fact that there's been a price premium for going electric. And we fundamentally believe that when you remove that barrier, it doesn't matter if it's a bus operator, the head of a commercial fleet, or in any segment, when you can buy an electric vehicle at the same price as a diesel vehicle, and you know that it's got a better total cost of ownership, it's easier to maintain, and it's good for the environment, there is no reason to purchase a diesel or fossil fueled vehicle anymore. The price point has been that barrier to the rapid adoption of these vehicles in these sorts of segments. And we're able to produce those vehicles at that competitive price. So we expect that there is no real limit to where the bus could go or the van. It's really going to be anywhere there's an existing bus or van, and mm-hmm. and those need to be refreshed. If the bus is at the right price point and the van is, and you have all these other benefits, like at the end of the day, our van's also, you know, best in class. We have really high payload and cargo volume capacity on our vans. The bus, I've talked about some of the user experience. So when you combine that with the right price point, with the fact that it's good for the environment, I don't think there's a limit to where this could go. And when you combine that with the production process of a microfactory being local, then you basically have a strategy that lets you go to any city anywhere in the world at the right time and convert the existing mobility solutions to electric.
Interesting. I love the idea of a city signaling its commitment to electric buses and then a microfactory assembling itself on the edge of town.
Exactly.
Well, I'm going to cover briefly the van. I mean, you obviously mentioned the obvious use cases for it too, but I'm also curious, you know, who you see as your customers in particular there. I mean, we know big splash deals by Amazon, for example, that, you know, it's planning to build its own internalized massive electric fleet. You know, do you imagine, you know, the UPSs and the FedExes of the world switching over soon, or, you know, will there be new use cases in terms of other players entering there? I'm curious who you already have traction with and how you imagine the van product evolving as you know, e-commerce and same day, same hour delivery becomes even more important.
Yeah, so actually UPS has been a long partner of ours. They've purchased the 10,000 vehicles with the option to purchase another 10,000 vehicles from us. They also have made an investment in Arrival. So they've been a long-term partner of ours. And so they'll obviously be shifting over their fleet as well. And the Arrival vehicle is a big part of how they do that. But it also extends out because for folks like UPS, you know, we mentioned the price point. But when you have that higher payload and you have that better cargo volume, you're actually able to change the composition of your fleet, because you're basically with this vehicle, you're able to carry more packages and a heavier set of packages. So you can actually reconfigure how you actually deploy your fleet and the number of vehicles you need across that fleet. So I think, you know, you mentioned Amazon, obviously UPS purchasing arrival vehicles, you're going to see significant traction across the let's say the large fleet operators, whether they're in e-commerce or logistics companies. But there is a broader impact here too, which is a lot of the market are the small, medium enterprises, you know, smaller fleets, individually owned or, you know, up to 10. And we believe that, you know, that will be that inflection point that I was mentioning earlier, where everyone shifts over, because the vehicle will be at the right price point for those folks too, who are also, you know, obviously concerned about the environment, but every dollar matters. And it's really important to have that vehicle at the right price. So the van is one of those segments that, you know, they're growing. The range of vehicles that they can buy right now are based on architectures that are about a decade old. Electrification, if it's not done correctly, doesn't solve the problem because it doesn't reduce the price point. And so likewise with the bus, it's exactly the same philosophy for the van and any other product that we design. And we share the technology across these programs, which helps us also get the price point down on the van. So we believe that the van will have significant market traction. You mentioned it's a growing segment. That is also a global segment. And it's, again, same philosophy. You put a microfactory there, you produce the right vans for that market. And the sales will be there. The demand is there already.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, well, I think we have the solution, Shota. The only thing bigger than the electric pickup truck is your own electric bus. When do those go on sale to individuals, I wonder? And how can I get them on the pre-order list?
Yeah, if we can just get Arrival to change their marketing strategy a little bit, we can be selling a 40-passenger bus to every, you know, image-conscious man in the suburbs.
I say nothing. Imagine that with that kind of torque. I mean, you know, the drag racing of electric buses up and down our streets would be truly a sight to behold.
2x4s you can grab from Home Depot with that bad boy.
Well, I look forward to President Trump or Biden offering, you know, massive EV tax credits on, you know, literally the heaviest vehicles that you can buy. So we can look forward to that. But yeah, I don't know how you're planning to spend the next 24 hours. I think fetal ball is going to do it for me. No matter what happens here, no matter who's elected, fetal ball is my appropriate move for November 4th. But yeah, how are you feeling going into it? I take it you've already voted?
I've already voted. I'm just, you know, the fact that we're upright and awake right now, I mean, I must have some sort of optimism in me. But if you're listening to this and you haven't voted for some crazy reason, please turn this off immediately and go vote. I don't know. I mean, otherwise, we'll find out by the next time. Hopefully, anyways.
Yes. Well, I was saying on that note, let's take it out here with a nice sober outro, because listeners, by the next time we're back in front of you, we'll be, well, either way, in a different world. One of the more momentous elections of our lifetimes as Americans, and lots to discuss in terms of potential policy of what's to come. Whether herd immunity, stated or unstated, continues, whether there'll be a change in administrations, there's going to be a lot to discuss.
Oh, and I want to say one more thing, Greg. If someone's listening right now, you know, hopefully they voted, but if you've got a mobility solution that's better than everyone driving their own bus or giant EV, you know, you're listening to this on Monday. This is the final day of the 2020 LA New Mobility Challenge submission deadline. So go to the Commotion LA website and get that application in now. And then also vote.
With that, I'll just add a shout out to all, speaking of mobility, a shout out to all of the companies out there. Micromobilities, several of them have stepped up to basically say that, you know, that rides to the two polling places will be free. I want to give a shout out to everybody who are out there who are running informal van services to get people there, even in the midst of a pandemic. Mobility is critical to people voting in this one. So, you know, again, the heart of our democracy is the ability to literally mobilize people and get them to the polls. So stay safe out there if you are voting in person this election day. And we thank you for your service. So with that, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us, as Jonah. Thank you all, as always, for listening, listeners. And we'll be back in a very different world next week. So stay tuned and we'll see you then.